Your Honors, may it please the Court, I'm Norwood Blanchard again, and I'm here in this matter on behalf of the defendant's appellants. This case is a qualified immunity case, or those are the primary issues that we're arguing about here as well. It arises out of the plaintiff's termination as police officers for the village of Bald Head Island. The incidents at issue took place in September of 2014, I believe. I'm trying to remember if it's 14 or 15. In any event, the plaintiffs had 15, I apologize, August of 15 and early September of 15. The plaintiffs had engaged in a text message exchange, and the text message exchange is in the record, so there's no dispute about what was actually said. That essentially consisted of jokes among police officers who were on the public safety force for the village of Bald Head Island. The village has very small.
A preliminary question. We got a lot to get to here, but I want to make sure that we cover this. So I want to skip to the defamation issue.
Yes.
Tell us your basis for our jurisdiction to hear that part of the case. Why do we have federal jurisdiction over this interlocutory appeal for that issue?
The question of whether the actual malice standard has been met in a defamation case against a public official is one that's immediately appealable under North Carolina law.
What does that have to do with federal jurisdiction?
It's a state law claim, just as if, say, for example, this were a public official immunity case. The court here has jurisdiction over it. I mean, it's supplemental jurisdiction or whatever you call it.
There are cases, including North Carolina state claims in federal court, where we have recognized under the collateral order doctrine that there is jurisdiction for a state public official immunity claim. But that's not a per se rule for all cases. And my recollection from your brief was that you argued that we had collateral order jurisdiction because there was a North Carolina rule that permitted appeal. But I don't think that cuts any ice for federal jurisdictional purposes.
It's a substantial right, just like public official immunity would be under North Carolina law. All we're changing is the form. I apologize, Your Honor.
Can you help me with the authority you have for that proposition? Because you would acknowledge, I suspect, that it's fairly unusual for federal jurisdiction to be dependent on the existence of the state recognition of a right to appeal an interlocutory order.
Right. It would be, I guess what I'm trying to say is, it would be a final order under 28 U.S.C. Section 1291, just like, you know, qualified immunity would be, because it's essentially deprives them of a right, the right not to stand trial on that issue. And I don't know that it's been specifically litigated in federal court, although we did cite, I believe, Bose Corp. versus Consumers Union, that it's reviewed under a de novo standard. And Anderson versus Liberty Lobby, I believe, also is one of those cases where it was that question was raised. But most of the time it does come up, the defamation cases, it comes up later. It does.
I'm not shaking my head about that. I just am having, I've not seen, this is a quirky argument, and I'm trying to parse it in my mind.
I don't want to belabor this because you've got some other issues, but in your briefing, you discuss the headings deal with actual malice. So there has to first be a prima facie case of defamation before you get to actual malice. But your actual brief argument doesn't deal with actual malice. It goes to the elements of defamation as to is it false, is it an opinion, and it just, there seems to be a disconnect there. Now, that may or may not be related to the jurisdictional question, but it is something of a puzzle.
I'll tell you where unfortunately, I covered that in more depth in the reply brief, because remember, actual malice, you have to show that subjectively the defendant who uttered those the alleged defamation knew that it wasn't true or subjectively had strong reason to believe it wasn't true. The issue in that one, the reason that actual malice isn't shown here for Peck, for example, is that everybody agrees that the evidence, what came to him was Dr. Mitchell coming to him saying, I got this complaint. I got this complaint. So I got this complaint and that I've talked with my command staff and they all agree that these guys, were being disrespectful, were being abusive, and that they need to be terminated. So Peck didn't know that there wasn't a complaint. Now, allegedly, Dr. Mitchell did. According to the plaintiff's evidence, Dr. Mitchell knew that there wasn't a true complainant, but that evidence never got to Peck. So he wouldn't have known that nobody complained about it. The only thing he knew was that somebody did complain about it. Their contention is that he didn't investigate that any further, but should have. But we know, as I pointed out in the brief, a failure to investigate before you publish is an actual malice under Fourth Circuit law or under U.S. Supreme Court law. So that's where the actual malice standard comes into play with respect to Peck.
I'm sorry, but I have to go back to this interlocutory order for just a second. The fact that it's qualified immunity, a claim of qualified immunity arises in the context of summary judgment, does it not? I mean, you appeal and you argue that you're entitled, it's immediately appealable because it raises an issue of qualified immunity. But the determination is whether it turns on a question of pure law or whether there's a factual underpinning. Because if there's a factual underpinning to the summary judgment question, then it's not appealable because it's just a summary judgment. How does this differ?
How does it differ in the case of the defamation case,
yes,
against a public official?
Yeah.
Now, that is a really good question about it, Your Honor, because
yes,
you're correct that ordinarily, it wouldn't be in a qualified immunity saying, arguing about, in a qualified immunity, if we agree what the law is, we're not arguing about the law, we're arguing about whether there was a tribal issue of fact.
Right.
All right.
Then that's not appealable.
That's not appealable. Now, it's different, though, for defamation, because remember, the trial judge has an independent duty under the case law, and the Court of Appeals has to make, Bose Court, they have to make a de novo independent review of whether there's sufficient evidence to survive summary judgment and even go to trial. Now, that also is what the Desmond versus N&O Publishing Company case that I cited, in our brief from the North Carolina Court of Appeals says, that it becomes a legal issue as to whether it goes to the jury or not. It's a legal, and I know that that's strange because you look at it, like you said, in the qualified immunity lens, arguing about the sufficiency of the evidence argues me out of court on an appeal. But it doesn't when it comes to defamation claims.
So if there's a conflict in the evidence, that's not factor?
Well, you still have to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. But the question then, and if I want to analogize it to qualified immunity, would be if the evidence that they've shown here that Peck didn't investigate it, would that survive summary judgment or should it survive summary judgment? Would it make out an actual malice case to go to the jury? And our contention is no, it wouldn't. So, and that's the odd part. We're not arguing an alternative view of the facts here. Our argument is, even under their view of the facts, it's not actual malice. I'm using the plaintiff's evidence on that to say that what they claim happened wouldn't amount to actual malice.
So even if your evidence is in conflict, which it would appear to be because you have claims that are made in the dismissal letters and emails to the employees about sexual harassment, inappropriate conduct under the village's code, but the two officers who supposedly were the victims of harassment say that never happened. So we're left with a conflict in your own evidence.
Well, they say we weren't offended, and you're correct about that, Your Honor. That's exactly what their testimony is. The point that we're making is to show actual malice. Not only would they have to say that, the claimants would have to show they said it and Peck knew it. And that's the breakdown here. Peck didn't know it. There's no evidence that he knows it. In fact, their evidence, their contention is that he didn't investigate. That's why he didn't know that. Now, Dr. Mitchell, on the other hand, is slightly different with respect to the defamation. She's alleged to have known it, but there's no indication and there's no allegation that she shared it with Peck.
Are you representing both Peck and Mitchell?
I do represent both Peck and Mitchell, and it's that issue didn't come up until later in the case. But remember, for that particular, those letters, Dr. Mitchell didn't write them, is the thing. Peck wrote them. He's the one who's attributed with them. But that's, again, that's an element of the claim. That's really not the issue that I'm getting into here. And I'm trying to figure out where to go back.
I didn't mean to sidetrack you to that extent on that issue.
I had anticipated speaking mostly about the free speech claims right here. And essentially, in a nutshell, the argument we were going to make about the free speech claim is that they're entitled to qualified immunity. You know, under the test, first you got to ask, was there an actual constitutional violation? Second, was the law clearly established? For them, we contend that it wasn't public concern speech. It wasn't protected, I should say, because, one, it wasn't public concern speech, and, two, reasonable officials could disagree as to whether the plaintiff's interest in the speech outweighed the defendant's interest in an orderly police department. Judge Duncan, you happened to be on the panel for the primary case, one of the two primary cases we cited, the Brickey case. The Brickey case, Brickey versus Hall, The court went to great lengths. And by the way, Brickey is a very recent case, published case, 2016, from this court, where this court held, it was clearly established in 2012 that police officials are entitled to impose more restriction on speech than other public employers because police forces are paramilitary. Discipline is demanded and freedom must be correspondingly denied. There's a heightened need for discipline, and police officials have greater latitude in dealing with dissension in their ranks. One of the interesting things about this, the plaintiff's contention on this, is that the speech was not disruptive because they weren't offended by it. But the problem is their bosses were offended by it. And
I thought their argument was that the speech was not, that their speech was public, that their speech was on questions of public concern.
Such as
the morale of the department and the qualifications of leadership and the statements that had been made in the press, which might or might not have been accurate about certain qualifications.
Judge Duncan, that's correct about their public concern argument. When we step into the second part, and I apologize, I hadn't talked about
that's Pickman, where you want to hang your hat is the clearly established part.
Yes. Well, and also, if you look at it, when I'm talking about clearly established law, when we're talking about that, The big reason they're entitled to qualified immunity is because no police official, after they looked at Brickey versus Hall and Krause, would look and say the Pickering-Connick balancing undoubtedly would come out in favor of the claimants in this one. The comments that they were making, the homophobic jokes,
so you know, was again, Brickey before or after they did this text exchange?
I apologize, Judge A.G.
Was Brickey before or after they did this text exchange?
The decision in Brickey came out after, but the court's holding in Brickey was that it was established as of 2012 that what the police officials could do. And the Brickey District Court opinion was before, obviously. So I guess the big issue for Brickey is Brickey holds that as of 2012, which would cover this time period, the law is clear, according to this court, that police officials can put great weight on the fact that these comments that were being made directly impugn the superiors. This is a small department, just like in Brickey and in Krause, 20 officers in total. And there's no way that an ordinary police official could distinguish the difference between the holding, what ends up being the holding in Brickey and Krause versus Liverman, I think, is the case that the plaintiff cites, or a firefighter case. These cases are very close, very factually analogous. And the court's holding here that, hey, every reasonable official would have known as of 2012 they could fire people under these circumstances. Now, that's not fair notice to my clients. This is a lightning bolt to them because, remember, under, you know, as we pointed out in our brief, the clearly established standard for qualified immunity is the same standard as for criminal liability, the fair notice standard. That comes from Hope versus Pelzer and U.S. versus Lanier explains that. The law has to be so clear and it has to put you on such clear notice that you could be criminally prosecuted for civil rights violations. And in light of the existing case law, that just didn't happen here.
I assume you're speaking to the First Amendment claim there.
Yes,
Your Honor. The liberty interest claim?
Right. And now the liberty interest claim is a little bit different. You know, in the liberty interest claim, they were given pre-termination process. One of the officers, Cannon, never asked for a hearing. In fact, skipped his pre-termination.
What about the others? They asked for it.
They asked for it, and it was denied. And that's where we get into the qualified immunity argument on this. Codd versus Velger and some of the other, I cited, I believe, a Fourth Circuit case that pointed out that if you don't dispute the underlying factual allegations, if you don't dispute the underlying factual allegations, there's no need to have a grievance hearing. That's the reason for having the grievance hearing.
I mean, I don't know that that makes any difference. I mean, the factual allegation is, was there this, you know, string of text messages, yes or no? But the point is whether or not the conclusions that the employer came to classify it in these derogatory ways, was there a dispute over that? Well, that never came up.
And it didn't. It didn't.
Wouldn't that be the purpose of the name-clearing hearing?
And that, as we pointed out in our brief, our argument was, well, all they were arguing about was whether or not the speech that they admitted making fell into one of these categories or not. And Peck didn't know that at the time. That's all they wanted to argue about. He thought they just wanted their jobs back. And that was, you know, again, mistaken.
Well, without having the hearing, how would you know that?
Now, Your Honor, one of the other bases, he wouldn't have. He wouldn't have. He didn't get that far. But one of the other bases was there is a circuit split on whether compelled disclosures implicate a liberty interest or not. This court hasn't yet addressed that issue. We cited published Sixth Circuit opinions saying they don't. This is a compelled disclosure. The reason this letter got out,
Peck wasn't compelled to email all the employees of the town and make these allegations public to them. That was not involuntary.
But, Your Honor, now that, if you want to talk about qualified immunity on that, there's no case law out there that we're aware of that the plaintiffs cited that that's a public disclosure for the purpose. It's an internal disclosure, certainly, and may support defamation liability. But the case law hasn't clearly established that that would have made out a liberty interest violation. Again, all we have to show to get qualified immunity is that there's unsettled case law on one of the elements of their claim. And we've shown that here. Qualified immunity is a pretty high bar for the plaintiffs to get over. There's no dispute that there's a circuit split about that one issue, about the compelled disclosure. So, you know, we contend that they're entitled to qualified immunity. There were other reasons that they had. They did have some alternative remedies. They could have, for example, placed a statement or they in their personnel file under the policy, or they could have contested just the contents of what was in their personnel file under the village's policy, but none of them ever asked for that. Again, I do have two clients here. One of mine, Mitchell, that was the issue about qualified immunity for her. She didn't have any involvement in their post-termination process. She was out of the picture by that point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have reserved some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Cox?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Bradley Cox. I'm representing the appellees in this case, Thomas Cannon, Jesse Connor, D.J. Coons, and Nick Nicholas Terrell. I'll go ahead and start with the defamation, since that's where we started. Mr. Blanchard is making a nice argument that he is can then knock down. It was an argument that we didn't make. We are not making the argument.
We have jurisdiction to hear any of these arguments.
Your Honor, I did not brief the jurisdictional arguments. And
any thoughts now about it?
Since we have to get to it first.
Yes, I understand that. I really don't. I mean, I'm here. I'm ready to argue.
Is falsity a part of the defamation inquiry?
Falsity? Yes, sir.
Why does that not speak to it?
Well, I think that the falsity, what Mr. Blanchard was talking about regarding the qualified immunity and trying to bring this in under the pendant jurisdiction, honestly, I can't speak to it here today. I didn't brief that.
You would have an opinion as to whether or not it's appealable.
Your Honor, our initial review of it after looking at the matter from Mr. Blanchard and their point of view, we thought that there was at least an argument that it would be appealable, and we thought the better course strategically was, frankly, to just go ahead and let's make the arguments.
Of course, if that issue's not appealable, then we would dismiss it, which would be in your client's favor.
And then we go back down to the district court case, and we have to try it, and then we might have to come back.
Well, that's what you want to happen, isn't it?
And that may be a bad strategic call, but that's what we did.
Okay.
But I will say that in regarding the malice element, we are not arguing that Mr. Peck should have done an investigation. That's not our argument. Our argument is Mr. Peck lied about why he terminated him, and he admitted that he lied about why he terminated him. He admitted in his deposition that he fired him for being jerks. He did not say that he fired him for harassment, sexual harassment, discourteous treatment, inappropriate electronic communications, like he put in his mass email, and like he and Mitchell went and took out of the personnel policy in order to fire them immediately.
So is that evidence sufficient for summary judgment purposes to show falsity for the element of actual malice? Is that your point?
That shows that there was certainly evidence and to defeat any type of summary judgment argument regarding the malice. As far as the
because
disputing
the claim
the facts.
Was false. Mr. Peck's claim was false.
Yes, sir. Right. He knew they were false. The only thing he didn't know is what Mitchell knew. And we do contend that that mass email was made public. It was sent to all of the employees in the village, not just the public safety officials, but everybody, plus part-timers who are consisting of part-time folks, volunteers. And there was nothing in that email saying that it was confidential. Going to the free speech issues and we talked about this being a matter of public concern. And
focus on the clearly established.
Sure.
I would like...
But go ahead. Just
at some point, talking about whether they were speaking as public citizens. Because and that feeds into clearly established.
Yes.
Because I think a plausible argument could be made that this is just trash talking. A lot of it was vulgar.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was filled with sexual innuendo that I had to ask for assistance deciphering. It just sounds like locker room talk mm-hmm. to me. So why were they speaking as public citizens?
Well, first of all, this is what we have is mixed speech. You have some speech that's clearly not of public concern. And then you have other speech that we would contend clearly is a public concern. And the speech that is clear, and just because you have speech that is not a public concern does not waive your free speech constitutional protections for the matter that is public concern. The matters that are a public concern are the matters of public safety. And they're not just of public concern, they're of utmost public concern or the highest public concern based on the, that's what the case in Goldstein versus Chestnut Ridge Volunteer Fire.
Except that even the statements about safety were tinged with personal grievances. If there is a dividing line, I think I would give it 30% public safety and 70% trash.
Well, there have been cases, the Campbell case, where there was just one line about sexual harassment or one complaint about sexual harassment in 13 pages of what the court said. These are all personal grievances. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at these text messages, a lot of it are even the jokes, and certainly the public safety is not a personal grievance. It's not, I am being affected because you're not doing this for me. This is you. I'm not able to get the training. And by the way, they're lying to the public about what training I'm getting. That's not, I didn't get a raise, I got demoted, or you're not helping my career. That's a personal grievance. This is much more broader than that. This is on the public safety issue.
Some of it is, yeah.
Yes.
And if you win on it, still you're nowhere. If you don't show, it's clearly established.
Right. That gets
so going to the clearly established, and I think again
the other side primarily argues.
Yes, sir. The what you have to show there is that under the Ashcroft is that the government official's conduct violates clearly established law.
So what would be you say would be your best case? It has some facts we can analogize to
the Cromer,
that this is clearly established.
Cromer versus Brown case. The Cromer versus Brown case, you had, and again, this is the Pickering balancing test, and we're saying they don't have anything on their side of it. They don't have anything to balance it, and that's what Cromer talked about. In Cromer, you had a matter of highest public concern. You had something that was made by a significant number of officers, like you have here. You have it was not made public, so there's no issue about undermining the department in the public eyes. You already had bad morale, and again, that's what Cromer said. And there was no direct working relationship with the leadership. In this case, we're talking about lieutenants and officers discussing these issues. They didn't have a direct working or daily working relationship with the chief and certainly not the town manager. So the Pickering test is so balanced on our side of it that it's clearly established. And that's exactly what Cromer said. They said that they found that the defendants there did not meet their burden for their qualified immunity defense. So that is that's the best case. But then you can also look at the Hunter versus Town of Moxville case, which is a police department case, the Durham versus Jones case. These are both Fourth Circuit cases, and these are both Fourth Circuit cases where there was complaints about misconduct in a law enforcement agency that the defendants were not allowed their defense of qualified immunity. I've also cited four additional cases around the country in four different circuits where you had an employee who was complaining about a public employee who was complaining about public safety. And again, there was qualified immunity defense was not given.
That feeds back into my question about the nature of the talk. And here there was a lot of talk that in fact I think the disproportionate amount of the talk did not address public safety. And even the public safety comments were phrased in terms of personal grievances against individuals. So if I'm having difficulty making that call about the public-private dichotomy, doesn't that also speak to whether a reasonable person in the in this position would have known that they were speaking as public citizens. If I'm having trouble, given what I do for a living, making that call.
Well, I think that's one part of the various factors that Cromer put out. Was this speech a matter of highest public concern? Did it affect the safety? Was it talking about public safety? And again, the long-established law is you look at all the speech altogether.
I did.
Yeah.
I read every painful word.
Right. Which, you know, they put together. I don't, you know, we don't know how many texts were before or after, but they're the ones that, that brought this together.
Well, you had input into the joint appendix.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. What I mean is we don't know what texts were before July 25th or after August 15th. Because some of the, especially the early ones, they weren't talking about public safety. But when you get into it, it's clear that it's clear to me that the major point that they were all focused on was this article that came out in the Stateport Pilot that says, hey, look at this. They're saying we're all trained. Somebody's going to die. That's what they said.
Mr. Blanchard said there's no case in the Fourth Circuit that addressed compelled disclosure. Do you agree with that?
And does what they're trying
to difference in this case?
Well, what the law is from the Cialino case about, and they established the elements. They have four elements: placed a stigma, made public, made in conjunction with a termination or demotion, and were false. They don't say anything about voluntary or compelled. Yes, sir. But they're not allowed to just make up an element and add it to Cialino. And also it has to be voluntary.
So the split in the other circuits is not affecting the
Well,
circuits.
One circuit out of all the other ones in dicta, I would not even call that much of a split, first of all. Second of all, under Ashcroft, you don't get the benefit of control. The clearly established law looks at the controlling authority in that jurisdiction in the Fourth Circuit. The only place this is controlling authority is in the Sixth Circuit. Or a consensus of cases of persuasive authority. The only thing they've cited in the Fourth Circuit is one district court case and a second district court, unreported district court case, which cites to yet another unreported district court case. So it's not controlling and it's not persuasive.
Well, does it make a difference here since you've got this email blast that goes out to all the employees?
Well, I think the difference there is that Defendant Peck was the one that sent the email out. We don't have any evidence that Defendant Mitchell had any responsibility regarding the email. Defendant Mitchell was the one that sent the Form F-5B that they're arguing was compelled.
Under your theory, wouldn't that be sufficient to take care of Defendant Peck for your purposes?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
So you have the three. You have the providing the form F-5B to the commission, mm-hmm. Emailing the department staff, and providing copies of the termination letter to the media after receiving FOIA requests.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not arguing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just establishing the universe.
Yes.
Is your argument the same with respect to each?
Essentially, yes. There are some nuances regarding whether or not it was compelled regarding the Form F-5B. There were some, and then which one of the defendants did what. They were both involved regarding the actual termination letters.
You mean the responses, the person who incorrectly believed that it was appropriate to release termination letters in response to a request, even though it was a personal
It's not, under Cialino again, it's not so much releasing the letters to the newspaper. It's putting the letters in the personnel file where there was a likelihood that they would be released to the public or to other prospective employers. That's
so you wouldn't put a termination letter in a personnel file?
You would. You would under North Carolina law. Yes, you do. And that's where it was.
So is your argument that in and of itself was sufficient to prove your due process liberty interest deprivation?
Yes, Your Honor, under Cialino, saying that was a personnel file case. There was information in that personnel file.
And just to complete the laundry list,
sure.
With respect to falsity, you rely, as you do under the defamation claim. Well, let me ask you, what do you rely on for falsity?
As far as the falsity is that they admitted that they did not terminate them for the reasons that were either in the Form F-5B or in the mass email or in the termination letter. They said they fired them for being jerks and talking. Yes. That's what they said. So they've admitted.
Which is kind of a nice way to say inappropriate email communications and difficulty getting along with people. Isn't that kind of a vernacular?
Well, the problem is inappropriate electronic communications is defined in the personnel policy, and it says something that can be easily accessible on the Internet. Well, these are text messages, and they can't be. But they didn't care about that. And certainly they didn't care about the sexual harassment, which is also defined in the personnel policy. It's all defined exactly how the courts define it when they're looking at this type of federal claims. And when I asked them in deposition, they couldn't tell me it was. They couldn't point to anything that was. That's all on the record. Let me just move on with my last 3 minutes here regarding the issue of the quote-unquote pre-termination hearing. It is not our contention that the law in the Fourth Circuit requires a adversarial pre-termination hearing. What our argument is that it, under Cialino, quoting the Armstrong Supreme Court case, is that there has to be a meaningful opportunity to respond to these false and stigmatizing charges in a meaningful time. Cialino says a meaningful time is before this dissemination of the public of this false and stigmatizing information ruins the reputation. So, and again, we're talking about qualified immunity. We don't have to worry about, well, was the pre-termination process or opportunity, was that meaningful or was it meaningful? There was no opportunity. These guys had no idea what was going on. They got to work that day and they said, you need to come talk to us. They weren't given even 5 minutes notice. They were told, you're terminated. The only question they asked was, do you recall being in some email or text messages in August, from July to August in 2014? That's the only thing that they asked. And then it said, you are terminated. And it said, there is no right of appeal. Turn in your badge and gun, escorted off the island. Now, that is not any type of meaningful opportunity. That's zero opportunity to argue and to have anything to protect their reputation. Hours after that, after Mr. Peck said, oh, we won't release this to the public, don't worry. Hours after that, he sends that email to everybody on the island. And then 24 hours, and then puts it in the personnel file, and 24, 48 hours later, it's in the newspapers. So, and they called Tom Cannon on the phone because he wasn't there, and they said, can you come in tomorrow? He says, no. It says, okay, well, you're terminated. You'll get your letter in the mail. That's not an opportunity, much less any kind of meaningful opportunity. So we're not trying to say that there has to be a full adversarial hearing, but there has to be some sort of meaningful opportunity. And we don't even have to decide I'm not asking the court to sort of check off the boxes and say this is the test now, because you can go back to the Matthews case in the Supreme Court. They've already said that. But, again, There's no opportunity here. I believe that's all of my argument. If you have any additional questions, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Cox. Mr. Blanchard?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Judge Duncan, I want to get back to a point that you raised just a minute ago. You hit the nail on the head in this one when you made the comment about this being mixed speech and being 70% trash-talking, essentially, and 30% of things that may have touched on a matter of public concern, but were tinged with personalized grievances towards the employer. That's exactly what happened. And as you said, there's a
plausible First Amendment claim you're speaking to.
That is, Your Honor.
The one that you say is not clearly established.
And you're right. And the reason that that's important.
If we believe that, then we go.
Yes. If you agree with Judge Duncan's assessment of it, that's it. Campbell, he talked about the
Campbell. I think I was expressing my sense of it rather than
an
assessment that should carry any weight.
Judge Duncan, that's correct.
I'll have to wait later to get an assessment.
The point that I was making is that a reasonable police official could have viewed the speech that way. And if they did, then it's not protected. Or at least they get qualified immunity because I briefed Campbell. I was involved in that one. Campbell, Connick versus Myers, tells us, what do you do in a mixed speech situation, right? You look at the form, content, and context. So it's not just the content. That's what they're talking about. It's also the context. And you talked about the context. It's trash talking between these employees. In Campbell versus Galloway, for example, yes, the plaintiff's argument was essentially the same as it is here. The plaintiff in that one said, Amy Campbell said, well, I was complaining about discrimination, and that's public concern speech. And this court held no, it's not necessarily public concern speech. You can't have a categorical rule like that because you take each case on its own. And where it's mixed, if a reasonable official, if it's close to that gray hazy line, they get qualified immunity. That's what you're seeing in all these mixed speech cases. The two cases that we talked about earlier, Bricky and Krause, both mixed speech. Some parts of it arguably were public concern. And they dealt with serious allegations of misconduct. This, there's no allegation. The things they're talking about is, these crude jokes about their genitalia and things like that. I mean, this is shop talk.
I think we take your point. And my only reason for raising it is that I think it absolutely, ultimately turns on qualified immunity. But in this instance, it seems to me it was a little more that the qualified immunity analysis was at least informed by the nature of the mix.
You're exactly right, Your Honor. And the compelled disclosure arguments that we talked about earlier, you asked Judge Wynn about a circuit split. And the point we were making is that it hasn't been directly addressed in the Fourth Circuit by the Fourth Circuit, but two district court cases
have
accepted.
The Scalino case.
Well, Scalino didn't directly address that issue, and the two district court cases. I apologize, Your Honor.
Didn't include the element.
It didn't include the element. I think it's
include an element that's in another circuit.
I don't know if it's more viewed as an affirmative defense or if it's a situation where that element is not present when it's a compelled disclosure. But the point we were trying to make is that two post-Cialino district courts, including one in the Western District of North Carolina, Jensen and the Louis case from Baltimore, both held that a compelled disclosure didn't implicate a liberty interest. They both came after Cialino, and
I'm
both of them
going
were affirmed.
Based on Cialino is a Fourth Circuit case. Everything those district courts say all around is not going to clearly establish any law in this Fourth Circuit.
Your Honor, I agree with you that it won't clearly establish
nor
it.
Or what is said in other circuits.
But what's important is that it does show a lack of consensus, and it shows a lack of clearly established law.
Not with regard to Cialino. I agree. It could be wrongly decided. It could be one I don't like, but I'm just going on what that case says. That's the law in this circuit.
I agree, Cialino is law. What the point we made is that Cialino didn't discuss that particular issue. It didn't directly address that. Nobody raised it as a defense.
They decided it without including that.
And I think partly because nobody raised it as an issue. In the two cases where it was raised, again, they're both unpublished opinions, but Louis and Jensen, The Fourth Circuit affirmed the district court's dismissal, and it did include
this. Key word again, unpublished opinion.
I agree.
That does not establish law.
And I'll go even further than that, Your Honor, to tell you that the Fourth Circuit didn't reach those issues in Louis or Jensen. But the point that I'm making is that trained judges come to the conclusion that a compelled disclosure doesn't implicate a liberty interest. And McVeigh versus Stacy, Wilson versus Lane, all of those other cases from this circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court say if
we
judges disagree
that.
About
you know
the
how
issue.
How many cases we could rewrite? We use that as a basis for what is that? Because clearly established that trained judges do it in other cases. But go ahead.
That was the point.
Just I'm still reeling from the implication that there are untrained judges.
All right, Judge Duncan. Fair enough.
Well,
let me ask the question that sort of I've been thinking about in this case in general, and that is, can in this village policy, can someone be insubordinate if they complain in private when off duty, but they follow orders with their own duty?
Yes, I believe they can. I believe they can. Their speech can cause such a breakdown. Ask it that this is the way we viewed it here, if I want to analogize it. If they said these things to their boss, to Chief Mitchell, to her face, would they expect to be fired? That's a simple way to look at it. And undoubtedly,
so
they would have been.
To take it where you're going, they are playing poker at one of the houses, and they're in there running their mouth while drinking and stuff. That can be insubordination, even though none of it is ever manifested on the job.
If it causes a breakdown in the relationship between them and their boss, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will come down and greet counsel and then take a very, very brief recess.